This past Christmas, I came across a novel by Virginia Woolf, and apparently it's her most famous novel. It's called To the Lighthouse. And on one level, it's just a very mundane story about a family who's kind of on an extended vacation at their oceanside home. In part one of the book, you're introduced to the Ramsey family. And the Ramsey family own this oceanside vacation home, and so they're staying there for this longer period of time. And surrounding them are their wonderful 8 children, and then a bunch of their friends also come with them and visit with them. The children are always spending their time down at the beach. The adults are painting and gardening and just chatting with one another. And there's this constant interaction of all the characters with each other. In the evenings, they gather for a large dinner, and there's celebration. There's family squabbles and things too, but it's this continuing togetherness, this ongoing narration of events. But then in part 2, Virginia Woolf does something quite compelling, and this is why this novel has become so famous. She changes voice entirely. 10 years pass in part 2 of the novel, and yet there is no narration of events. Nothing as in this happened, then this, and this, then this happened. Rather, what she does is she changes the style completely, and she spends her whole time talking about the ravages of time, and the way that death seems to take absolutely everything from us and its power over our lives. Then, in part 3, the story goes back to just like it was in part 1, and it's a narration of events, but it's very clear that something has changed. Part 2 has very clearly said, something in this story has changed, and now the vacation home has fallen into disrepair. There hasn't been any vacations for 10 years. What has happened? In part 3, you learn what has happened. 10 years have passed. The family is now back at the vacation home with some of the friends. But it's very evident now that one of the sons has died in war. One of the daughters has grown up to become a mother but died in childbirth. And Mrs. Ramsey, who was really the joyful center of the entire family, has also died. And so in the final section, everything goes back to the very beginning, because in the beginning, Mr. Ramsey was getting pestered by his children who really wanted to go and take a boat ride out to the old lighthouse. But Mr. Ramsey was just a little too occupied with his work and discussing with his friends all of philosophy and the things that were on his mind. And so he never went on this boat ride. He always pushed the children aside. But now in part 3, at the very end of the book, everything flips. Now it's Mr. Ramsey who's so desperate to go to the lighthouse. But the children have now become teenagers and they don't care anymore. And yet Mr. Ramsey drags all the reluctant teenagers along on a boat ride trip to the lighthouse as he seeks to try to recapture something they once had, but now has been lost. This is what he's always wanting to get. And so why this book is so powerful, it's a very mundane story, but it haunts you when it is done. It haunts you because it is so true to real life. There's, of course, many wonderful things that we enjoy in life, for children and vacations and all these kind of things. But as we have been learning in the last few weeks through this book of Ecclesiastes, everything is like a breath. All these seasons of life, like a breath, are fleeting. You try to grab onto them, you can't. You try to control them, to try to shape them and try to maintain them like Mr. Ramsey did, you can't do it. Once the season has passed, it is gone, and all the seasons of life are fleeting just like a breath. And then, of course, the big picture that we've been learning, and as also is in this story, life is like a breath in the sense that it is fleeting and we will all die. And nowhere was this more true than in our own culture this past week, wasn't it? I mean, it was last Sunday, right when we were going through Ecclesiastes, that Kobe Bryant and his daughter and then 7 other people perished in the helicopter crash. I have not seen our culture so aware of the fact that life is a breath in a very long time. Somehow, this has resonated right through our culture, and everyone at this moment is fully engaged, fully believes, and is in touch with reality that everything is hevel. That all is a breath, as we've been saying. So here's the question that we come to then. If this is how life is, how do we live if we cannot control the wind? If we cannot make this breath longer than it is, how should we live if we cannot control the seasons of life? How do you enjoy life and not fall into despair over the fact that everything's a breath? How do you not get stressed out and exhausted by trying to control it? Because that's exactly what happens, isn't it? We can fall into despair or into exhaustion from being stressed out. On the one hand, we can fall into despair. Despair because we want to hold on, like Mr. Ramsey does, to those, maybe say, the young childhood years of our children. And yet, those years are fleeting. They're so quickly gone. We want to hold on to our athletic abilities and things we enjoy when we're young and strong, and yet athletic ability crumbles. All the things that we enjoy in life, they're seasons, but they are so fleeting, and then they're gone. So how do you not fall into despair when the seasons of life, like a breath, go in and go out and are gone? And then also, how do you not get stressed out and become totally exhausted? Because here's what we often try to do. We try to control these seasons. We try to control our lives, to shape it like the wind. We try to grab onto it. I just want to hold on to this season. And yet you can't do that either. And so here's where so many of us go, and this will resonate with you right away. We try to control things which cannot be controlled, and then we end up becoming what we call control freaks. And we all know that control freaks are very difficult to be around, and if you become one, it's very difficult, and you constantly live with a level of stress that is too high. I cannot tell you how many families I have seen torn apart because parents cannot let go of their adult children's lives and seek to control their adult children's lives so much that the children eventually just say, I can't handle it anymore, and they push their parents away, and the parents are back saying, we've just been trying to help you the whole time, and the kids are saying, we can't handle it anymore, you're a control freak, and it destroys the entire family because the parent, adult children have a good desire to help their children, but they're trying to shepherd the wind. They're trying to control everything, and they destroy their children's lives and their families. Have you seen that? So here's the question. How do we live when all these seasons of life are like a breath? How do we not fall into despair because we can't hold on to them? And how do we not become exhausted and stressed out because we try to control the wind which cannot be controlled? This is where we're going to go in Ecclesiastes this morning. This passage offers us such powerful wisdom. It shows us how to find joy instead of falling into despair. It shows us how to find rest instead of trying to control everything. So do you want joy? Do you want less stress in your life? Then Solomon says it's time for you to do four things. It's time for you to face reality. It's time for you to let it go. It's time for you to seize the day, and it's time for you to fear the Lord. These all will build on one another, and then we're going to backtrack them because then it'll even make more sense. First then, if you want joy, if you want less stress, then Solomon says the first thing you need to do is it's time for you to face reality. It's time to face reality. Look again at Ecclesiastes chapter 3. You remember that the author is Solomon, who calls himself the preacher. And he begins chapter 3 now in a different note. We're into a new section of Ecclesiastes. He begins with a statement about time. Look at verse 1. For everything there is a season, and a time for every matter under heaven. And then notice verses 2 to 8, he gives a very famous poem about all the times, about all the seasons that we face in life. And of course, if you grew up in the 60s, or I said a few weeks ago, if you're Generation X like me, and Forrest Gump was one of the biggest movies of your life, then you well know the famous song which is going through your head right now, Turn, Turn, Turn by the Birds. Now it's going to be in your head all week long. I just got it going for you. But Solomon was not wearing a tie-dye t-shirt when he wrote Ecclesiastes 3. And Ecclesiastes 3, though I actually think the birds apply it mostly right, it's not primarily a peace anthem in response to Vietnam. So let's make sure that we don't read the birds in Vietnam straight into Ecclesiastes chapter 3. There's a lot more here for you. Notice, first of all, let's just look at this poem. This poem is a masterpiece of literature. In this poem, the preacher, Solomon, describes every experience in life. What he's trying to do is capture absolutely all of life into one poem. And the way he does this is he describes really opposite ends of a spectrum many times. So, for instance, just look at verse 2. a time to be born and a time to die. Which then, those are opposite ends, which means everything in between is included. That's how the poem begins. You can also see how he's really trying to capture all of life by his masterful use of the number seven. In the Bible, the number seven represents completeness. And I would have you note that in this poem, the word time appears 28 times, which is seven times. Oh, see, come on. All right, seven times four. Then notice also these 28 uses of the word time are distributed over 14 lines, which is seven times. You people are edumacated, you know that? Very edumacated. 14 times, and then you notice they're into couplets. There's seven couplets, each verse being a couplet. So you got 28, you got 14, you got seven. The whole entire thing then is meant to show you this is a complete view of all of life. This poem has artfully and masterfully captured all of the changing seasons of life, the good and the bad, and the joyful and the painful. Then notice also, if you just look at these couplets, we don't have time to go into all of them, but you cannot control all the times and seasons of your life, can you? Let's just look at verse 4, for instance, with me. Verse 4, the first line is, there's a time to weep and a time to laugh. So one night, maybe you're at a comedy club or you're watching a good movie and you're laughing your head off because there's some great humor in it. And the next night, you get a phone call, which completely leaves you in tears and keeps you up for the evening. Or the second half, a time to mourn and a time to dance. So one day you're dancing with your daughter at her wedding, and then a little while later you are holding her in your arms as you're mourning with her that she's lost her baby. A time to mourn and a time to dance. All of this Solomon is trying to capture for us into one thing. And notice that just like life, this poem has a steady rhythm to it. I mean, this is why the bird song is so good. There's a rhythm, a time to this, a time to that. And they get it from this poem, a time for this, a time for that. And yet even amongst this steady rhythm of changing seasons, one to a next, just like life, mark this, there's no overall structure to this poem. There is no, this time naturally flows to that, which everybody knows flows to that. No, it's all over the place. There is joy, then there's sorrow. There's war and peace. There's hate and love. There's no structure. There's no order. There's a rhythm to the changing seasons of life, and yet no overall order that we can seem to feel as we experience life. Isn't this a masterful poem? All the changing seasons of life. And then just when you're admiring this poem and how much it captures and resonates with how reality truly is, Solomon sucker punches you from behind. Amongst all the seasons of life, he then comes to this, verse 9. What gain has the worker from his toil? This is the exact same question you remember from chapter 1. It's the thesis question over the entire book that we've been looking at. For all of your effort, for all the times you've experienced, for all the things that you've said in all the seasons of your life, you've done all this effort into your life, and what do you have to show for it when it's all done? He doesn't even need to give the answer here, because if you've been here the last few weeks, the answer's been very, very plain, hasn't it? Nothing. That's the answer. At the end, you die and you are forgotten. Everything is a breath. Everything is a vapor. After all these seasons of life and all of this effort, all the joy, the love, the pain, and the sorrow, we will all die. And we will eventually all be forgotten. There is no ultimate gain because life is a breath. So once again, we see the preacher is trying to make us face reality. So he's saying to us, if you want to learn how to find joy, how to live wisely, you need to come face to face with reality. And he's driven this point home for the past few weeks. And what is reality? It is this. You must see that you live in a fallen but a beautiful world. It's both fallen and it's beautiful. So that life moves from one season to another. That you cannot control most of the seasons of your life. And that in the end, you, like a breath, are fleeting, and you will ultimately die. So he's saying, if you want to find joy and rest, then the preacher is saying to us, the first thing you just got to do is face reality. All these changing seasons, you can't really control most of them. And at the end, it's all a breath. Once again, emphasizing his main point. But now what he does is he goes on to reflect upon his poem and to give us some interpretation of it from a Godward perspective. So the second thing we want to do after we face reality is this. Second place, it's time for you to let it go. It's time for you to let it go. We cause ourselves endless frustration when we try to find the answers for why one season moves to another. Why does this happen? Why does that happen? And we cause much mental frustration. We also exhaust ourselves, stress ourselves out as we try to constantly control everything in our life to avoid the changing of a season. But the preacher wants us to have rest. And how do you get that? You got to let it go. Yep, sing the Frozen song. Go ahead. It's in your head. I know it is. Let it go. Right? So if that song's in your head, that's fine. We did Frozen last week. We can do it again this week. You got to let it go. That's what Solomon's getting at. In other words, you got to let go of thinking that you need to have the answers to all the questions because you can't have them. You got to let go trying to control everything because you cannot control the wind. You got to let it go. Now, how do you do that? Here's how you do it, verses 10 and 11. He says, look at them. I have seen the business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. Here's the key line. He has made everything beautiful in its time. Also, he has put eternity into man's heart, yet so that he cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. Oh, what rest there is in these verses for you and I. Notice that the times of your life, mark this, the times of your life are not the result of blind, random chance. The changing seasons of your life are not the result of the cold hand of fate. No. You might have thought that even back during the poem because you noticed that God did not appear anywhere in this poem. He's just simply reflecting life as it is. But now he's interpreting it and he wants to show us how to think about all these changing seasons in life. And the key, he says, is to rest in the fact that God has scheduled every season and he will bring them all together. That's that phrase. Notice verse 11. God has made everything beautiful in its time. The key is resting in this fact. That little word made, this is the key word for you to camp out on. Remember, I've told you before that Solomon's constantly reflecting on Genesis 1 to 3 and even 4 and 5. Again, that's the same word as Genesis 1. That God made the fish of the sea. He made the birds of the air. He made the dry land. So you are meant, as you read this, to recapture Genesis 1. This God who's so powerful can create the heavens and the earth. He can make all of these things on the earth. But it's not just that he's the all-powerful creator, the master over all of creation. Now is he's the all-powerful God over time. Over everything that happens, over all the seasons of life, he is the Lord over creation and he is the Lord over time. That's what we're getting at now. And he's saying that the seasons of life are not random, they're scheduled. And we want to know how it fits together. That's always the question we're asking. How does this all? Why this? But notice that God, though he has given us a desire to understand his eternal ways, he has made it so that we cannot know the beginning from the end. We are creatures. We cannot know the mind of God and all that he has done. So, put this together. Do you see how this can bring you rest? You can now let go of the questions and the need for control and find rest knowing that God is in control and he, the all-wise one, knows what he's doing. Really, this verse 11, he has made everything beautiful in its time, that may be the greatest verse in all the Bible on what we call the providence of God, the invisible hand of God at work in all things. And the New Testament equivalent to it is this, Romans 8:28, that God works all things together for good for those who love him and have been called according to his purpose. Now, One of the best illustrations of this comes from Corrie Ten Boom. If you know Corrie Ten Boom, if you've read The Hiding Place, which if you haven't, you should. That should be a must read in your life. My teenage daughter's reading it right now. It's a great book. You probably get it at the library. I'm not sure. Corrie Ten Boom was, her and her family helped to hide Jews during World War II to escape the Holocaust. Unfortunately, she and her family got caught for doing this, and they were sent to one of the concentration camps. Sadly, within this concentration camp, Corrie's sister, Betsy, died. And so The Hiding Place is all about that story. So here is a woman now who knows what it means to face suffering, to face trials. Because as soon as I've talked like this, probably where your mind is going is, yeah, but what about all the difficult things in my life? That's where your mind starts to go. But Corrie, after she got out of the concentration camp, spent the rest of her days going around the world telling people about the hope there is in Jesus. So listen, this is not a woman who is naive to the sufferings of life. This is a woman who has probably been in the worst of all human suffering. I think most of us agree the Holocaust is right up there with the worst of all possible human suffering. Here is a woman who knows what it means to face a time of war and live in a time of peace. A woman who knows what it means to laugh and what it means to mourn. What it means for people to kill and to hate and what it means to spend time enjoying life. She knows it. If you ever go to the Netherlands, there is a museum dedicated to her, and there you will find this object, this on the wall. Here's the picture. Now, try to figure out what is that. This is an object that Corrie used to take to all of her talks that she gave after World War II. And as you can see, what it looks like is a gigantic mess of colored threads, right? Just kind of chaos all over the place. And Corrie would go to her talks. She'd hold up this object in the museum now. And she would talk to her audience about this is what life feels like, doesn't it? It's chaotic. There's all this colored thread. You can't make rhyme or reason out of so many things. But then she would go on and she would speak about God, his ability to control all time, his sovereignty over all events, even when we don't understand them, and how he is going to work out everything to his desired end. And then when she had got to the high point of her talk, she would take this tangled mess of threads and she would turn it over to reveal the other side. And here's what it looks like on the other side. So it's a tapestry. That's what we call a tapestry. So it forms, all those colored threads form this picture of a crown. So from the underside of this tapestry, everything is chaos. Everything just doesn't fit together. There's no rhyme or reason. Just like the poem in the beginning of Ecclesiastes 3, you say, there's a beautiful thread. Oh, there's a black thread. You don't know how it all fits together. It seems there's no structure at all to it. And yet when you see the tapestry from the upper side, what do you learn? You learn that every single thread has been woven with purpose and all fits into a bigger whole. He has made everything beautiful in its time. Then Corrie would go on to read this poem. My life is but a weaving between my God and me. I cannot choose the colors. He weaveth steadily. Oft-times he weaveth sorrow, and I, in foolish pride, forget he sees the upper, and I, the underside. Not till the loom is silent, and the shuttle cease to fly, will God unroll the canvas and reveal the reason why. The dark threads are as needful in the weaver's skillful hand as the threads of gold and silver in the pattern he has planned. He knows, he loves, he cares. Nothing this truth can dim. He gives the very best to those who leave the choice to him. Do you want to know how to live wisely? To live with joy, to live with a deep sense of just rest in your heart? Then Solomon is saying you need to face reality. And then you got to let go this idea that you can control everything, that you could know all the answers why, to stop wearing yourself out with all that. The key to letting it go is not some psychological technique or just breathe better or something like that. No, the key to letting it go is trusting that there is a God who made the universe, and the God who made the universe is also making everything beautiful in its time. And on this, the underside of the tapestry, which is where we look, everything does not seem to fit. It seems often there is no meaning and no purpose. And yet, from this text, maybe the greatest in the Bible on this topic, we see that God is the great weaver who is weaving every thread of your life and my life into some giant whole which we cannot see now. But one day he will flip over and reveal what he has woven. The great tapestry of time. So, the first thing you need to do is face reality. The second thing is to let it go. Now, in the third place, the preacher says, it's time for you to seize the day. Once you've done this, now it's time for you to seize the day. Carpe diem, right? Seize the day. Look at verses 12 and 13 with me now. I perceive that there is nothing better for them than to be joyful and to do good as long as they live. Also, that everyone should eat and drink and take pleasure in all his toil. This is God's gift to man. Now, once again, I want to point out to you that it is wrong to see Ecclesiastes as a depressing, cynical book about a man who did not know God, and finally at the end, now the narrator's going to come in and correct everything that's been wrong throughout the whole book. Once again, I point out to you that the preacher is coming to the same conclusion as he did at the end of chapter 2. Since we all die, and since we cannot control life as to gain something, he says to live wisely means you should seize the day. It's from God. This is a God-centered perspective again. You see that? God is all right through it. And he shows you two ways that you should seize the day. First, seize the day by enjoying your life as a good gift from God. Just enjoy the day because God has given you this very day. That's what he's saying, right? Everyone should eat and drink and take pleasure in all his toil. Why? It's God's gift to man. Carpe diem, he's saying. Seize the day and enjoy it as God's gift. But let's just ponder on this for a moment. We've heard that phrase carpe diem a lot in our culture, and really I think this last week everyone has been keenly aware of it in the wake of Kobe Bryant's death. And so what is everybody saying this last week? Everyone's saying, hey, we see reality clearly. We're not ignoring this fact that life is hevel. Everyone gets it right now for a couple days, and everyone is now saying, go home and hug your kids. Go make up with the person who you've done wrong with or someone you haven't talked to for a while. You never know. You could die. It could all be over. Everybody's in touch with this. Everybody is saying carpe diem. So is Solomon saying anything different than, you know, what Oprah will tell you or what anybody will tell you this week? Carpe diem. Is there anything different between his advice and what everybody is saying that you should do this week? I mean, really, this idea of carpe diem was really popularized for us back in the 1980s. Anybody live old enough to remember the film that really did this? Any takers? Yes. Big marks over there. Dead Poets Society. So Robin Williams plays a teacher at a private boys' school. He shows up at this school and begins to teach these boys. And one of the key scene is he takes all the boys to the trophy case. And he shows them all the trophies from the past, the sports heroes, right? And there's pictures of all these men in the past who went to the school, went on and did great things. But of course, all these men are now dead. And so he has the boys standing around this trophy case, and he asks them, what do you think all of these dead sporting heroes would say to you right now? And as they're pondering it, he walks amongst them, and he whispers, carpe diem, carpe diem, carpe diem. And then the rest of the film is basically what happens when a group of boys live carpe diem. Some of it's very humorous, and some of it is very tragic. So is that what Solomon's saying to us? Is he saying, carpe diem, go out, just do whatever you want in your life, whatever will make you happy, whatever will bring you pleasure and joy, just go out and do that. That's what you need to do. No, it's similar, but it's different. Yes, we must seize the day and enjoy our lives because life's a breath. So you've only got today. So yes, he's agreeing on that level. But can you see where his advice is different? What's the big difference? God. God is at the very center of his advice, isn't it? Yes, you should do all this, but you got to do it within the worldview that all of your life is a gift from your Creator. This very day is a gift from your Creator. And so you should go out and carpe diem in light of the fact that you have a Creator. So that does change things, doesn't it? Just a little bit. He's not saying anything goes, enjoy whatever pleasure you want. No. Rather, the wise person learns what it means that God is our Creator, that recognizes everything comes from His hand, that yes, we should enjoy His good gifts, but we got to make sure that we're doing it within the boundaries that He has given us. For the wise person knows that the Creator knows best. So if He says, don't do something, you don't do it. You don't carpe diem. You follow your Creator in His paths, and you live and enjoy the day He's given you. So yes, go home and hug your kids. Go call the person who you've been at odds with for a long time, because just like Kobe Bryant, you could die this afternoon. Go home and enjoy your lunch. Enjoy watching the Super Bowl. Do whatever it is. If you like music because you hate the Super Bowl, go listen to some good music this afternoon. I know you're not all sports people. I don't understand you, but whatever it is that you like to do that God has given you, if it's pottery this afternoon, go make a nice little pot or something like that. If it's watching sports, go enjoy your sports. Seize the day, but remember, all of it is God's gift to you, and seize it in a way that honors Him and gives thanks to Him. Your life's but a short breath, so don't feel guilty about it. Enjoy your lunch, hug your kids, and enjoy the rest of this day. That's what Solomon is saying. Live in the moment. But secondly, notice he says, seize the day by doing good with what God has given you. Not just go out and live for yourself. Look at verses 12 and 13, because this makes it, again, quite different from the carpe diem of Dead Poets Society or even other people. Verse 12 makes it clear. I perceive that there is nothing better for them than to be joyful and to do good as long as they live. In other words, you are to seize the day by using the gifts God has given you, the resources He's given you, and blessing other people. So the question then becomes, how can you use your short life to bless others, to work for the cause of Christ, to make a difference in this world? And yes, many of the things you do go unnoticed. They're small acts. But never forget, God sees all the small acts. And it's all the small acts that begin to weave the great tapestry of your life, which is part of the giant tapestry of all that God is shaping in history. So carpe diem, in the biblical sense, means to enjoy each day as a gift from God, giving thanks to Him, and using your life to do good for others. So if you want to live wisely and with joy, the preacher's saying you got to face reality, you got to let it go. Then you can seize the day, but there's one last thing that must be at the very center of your life. In the final place, he says, it's time for you to fear the Lord. It's time for you to fear the Lord. If you want to live wisely in all the things we just said, then everything must begin by standing in awe and having reverence for your Creator. As the Proverbs say, The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. That's where you begin. If you want to learn how to live a wise, joyful life, it begins by standing in awe of your Creator. To help us stand in awe of our Creator, the preacher contrasts two things. Our inability to control time, we've talked about that, but God's ability to do so. And this should make you just stand in awe of your Creator. So look what he says in verse 14. I perceived that whatever God does is hevel. Is anybody with me today? All right, you want to go watch the Super Bowl. That's not what it says. Whatever God does is not a breath. Whatever God does endures forever. What a contrast to everything that's come so far. Nothing can be added to it, nor anything taken away from it. And why has God done all of the works that He has done in time? God has done it so that people fear before Him. Now, let's clarify. We're going to do this much more in depth in a couple weeks. To fear God does not mean to be scared of Him and to run away in terror. To fear God means to revere Him, to stand in awe of Him. And what is it that should make you stand in awe of Him? this fact, that everything you do is a puff of breath that is fleeting and gone. Everything you do is mostly an effort at controlling wind. But everything God does endures forever. That nothing can be added or taken away. What he sets out to accomplish, he accomplishes. So listen, you learn this lesson every day of your life. You're supposed to learn it every day of your life. Every time you get stuck in traffic, every time you get sick, our family's been throwing up all week. It's not been very fun. Our whole family went down this week. So every time you're sick and you cannot do normal life, every single time you cannot fix a situation, all of that reminds you, as we said last week, you are not a God. You cannot control the wind. And that is all supposed to humble you. All those experiences, every time you're frustrated, you should be reminded, I'm a creature. I cannot control life. I am not a God. And then on the flip side, it's supposed to make you stand in awe. You're supposed to reflect on God. You cannot control the wind. But there is one who can control the wind. How does he do that? I don't know. How can he control and shape wind? How can he cause all events to come to pass? How can he shape the seasons of life? It is so beyond my mind, it's supposed to cause us to stand in awe of him, to revere him, to say, I cannot understand anything, God. I mean, I can't even understand my own thoughts and feelings, let alone my wife's. That's even way more difficult. And now I've got teenagers. That's even the whole other level. I can't grasp any of this. I can't control any of anyone's lives. In my own, and yet you, O God, control all the seasons and times. I stand in awe of you, that you could do this. Stand in awe of God, for you and I cannot control the wind, but he controls all time. C.S. Lewis expressed this so well in his little book called The Screwtape Letters. If you haven't read it, it's a little fictional book about a senior demon writing letters to a younger demon about how to destroy the life of the man the younger demon has been assigned to. Fictional book, don't worry, it's not real, but it's profound, a lot of it. And the senior demon says there's one key way you can really manipulate and destroy this man's life, and it has to do with the man's concept of time. And in one letter, the senior demon points out how upset human beings get when a portion of their time gets taken away from them. Like when you've got plans for the night and then something interrupts them, you want to relax, and then someone shows up at your door, and you have this feeling that your time has been stolen from you. And so the senior demon says, you can use that to destroy the man's life. So listen to what the senior demon writes. Remember, this is a demon writing to a demon. He says, you must therefore zealously guard in his mind the curious assumption, my time is my own. Let the man have the feeling that he starts each day as the lawful possessor of 24 hours. Let him feel as a grievous tax that portion of this property of time which he has to make over to his employers. I have to work today. It's my time, but I have to give it to my employers. And as a generous donation, that further portion which he allows to religious duties. That's good. He says, you have here a delicate task. The assumption which you want him to go on making is so absurd that if once it is questioned, even we cannot find a shred of argument in its defense. The man can neither make nor retain one moment of time. It all comes to him by pure gift. He might as well regard the sun and moon as his possessions. The sense of ownership in general is always to be encouraged. Make the man think that time is his own. The humans are always putting up claims to ownership, which sound equally funny in heaven and in hell, and we must keep them doing so. And all the time, the joke is that the word mine, in its fully possessive sense, cannot be uttered by a human being about anything. In the long run, either our father, referring to the devil, or the enemy, referring to God, will say mine of each thing that exists, and especially of each man. They will find out in the end, never fear, to whom their time, their souls, and their bodies really belong. Let's put all this together now and work backwards through the points to make it all make sense. If you want to live wisely, if you want to find joy, It begins at the center of living before your Maker, to fear, to stand in awe of your Creator. Humble yourself before Him. Ask His pardon for not living for Him. It begins with the fear of the Lord. With that as your foundation, now you can go out and you can seize the day. You can enjoy it. You can live for it. You'll know how to live because your whole life is under the fear of the Lord. You'll live rightly and you'll live to enjoy life and to do good for others. And then, as you're enjoying the moment, you can let go of trying to control everything all the time because you know now you can see reality clearly. You can see that God is weaving a great tapestry through all the times and all the seasons of your life, even if you cannot fully see it. That's what Solomon is saying to us here. But now listen to this. Solomon's view of time and of God is so freeing, it should cause you to stand in awe of God. Just this passage alone should make you go, wow, okay, this is just absolutely incredible. But you know what? When we come to the New Testament, we see a whole other level to the teaching that Solomon has given. For there we learn that God, throughout all the Old Testament, Solomon's words included, had been weaving his tapestry, but all of it had been weaving to one key point. In other words, God was shaping all the seconds of history up to one great moment, which the Apostle Paul calls the fullness of time. In the fullness of time, God sent forth His Son into the world. God Himself came from out of time and entered into time and space history in the person of Jesus Christ. Why did He come? He came to put an end to all the old times of death and of mourning and of pain and of suffering. He came to start, to begin new times, a new creation. That's why He came into the world. And to accomplish this, Jesus Himself said that the times of His life, all the seasons of His life, were all moving towards what He called the hour. All the seasons, all the rolling seasons of time throughout all the history of the universe were being woven by God. All those times came to a fullness of time. And all the fullness of time, Jesus says, comes down to an hour. And what is the hour? Jesus said the hour was that period of time when He would be crucified upon the cross. The hour was when Jesus, the sinless one, suffered and died on the cross in order to defeat our sin, to remove it from us, to defeat the devil himself, and to defeat death. And when the hour was done and He was laid in the grave, He laid there for 3 days. Time ticked along. It seemed that His great plan had failed. It seemed that God's plan for the fullness of time no longer worked because the clock ticked and ticked and ticked and there was no life. But on the third day, God raised Him from the dead. And with the raising of Jesus, what you have right there is the beginning of God's new creation. With the raising of Jesus, now you have the start, the beginning of a new period of time. And Jesus is the one who begins it and ends it. He is called the Alpha and the Omega. That is the first letter and the last letter of the Greek alphabet. He is the A and the Z, the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end, the first and the last. And the book of Revelation says that Jesus is the Lamb who is worthy to open the scroll, to open all the seals, which is a picture that Jesus alone is able to cause all of future history to come to pass because He is the Lord of time now. It's because He was slain that He is able to do this. And all of time is now marching forward to the day when Jesus, the Lord of time, will once again enter space-time history and He will end it all. The time is coming when He will return. The time is coming when He will judge the world. And the time is coming when His new creation, which was launched in His life, death, and resurrection, will become a reality for all of His people. Friends, one day, in the new creation, the poets of the new creation, maybe you'll be one of them, will rewrite Ecclesiastes chapter 3. And when we rewrite the poetry in the new creation, there will be no word that says there's a time to die, for death will be no more. When the poets of the new creation rewrite Ecclesiastes chapter 3, words like hate, killing, mourning, and war will not appear. Why? Because such words will have fallen out of use. They will be meaningless concepts. There will be no words because they have no meaning. For in the new creation, all will be times of planting, times of building, times of laughing, times of dancing, times of embracing, and times of peace. Until Jesus came, the clock of history was perpetually ticking towards the darkness of midnight. But with the coming of Jesus, the clock has struck midnight. Oh, it's still dark. But the tide has turned. Midnight bells have rung, and we are now rushing forward to the dawn. As Paul writes in Romans, the night is far gone, the day is at hand. Or in the words of an old hymn, the sands of time are sinking. The dawn of heaven breaks. The summer morn I've sighed for, oh, that fair sweet morn awakes. Oh, but dark, dark hath been the midnight. But dayspring is at hand, and glory, glory dwelleth in Emmanuel's land. Trust God's weaving of your life. Enjoy the day. Do good. Humble yourself before your Maker. And find hope that the great weaver of time will one day once again enter space-time history, reveal the great tapestry of all time, and we will fall down and worship in our Savior's land. Let's pray. Father, forgive us when we as mere mortals try to act like gods and we stress ourselves out endlessly when we do this. We cause ourselves much anguish and sorrow. Father, we humble ourselves before you. You alone control time. And we're grateful that we do not live in a universe where all is random, where there is no meaning or purpose, but we live in a universe ruled by one who can not only create a universe, but can weave every season of life into your own tapestry. We stand in awe of you, we revere you, and we want to give you the praise that is due to you. Help us to rest. Grant each of us that rest in your great sovereign power over the seasons of our lives. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.